Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Salieri Report Don Cox of Cox Advisors. He's just published an incredible Cox Strategy Journal for May 2015 on negative interest rates, and it's I always look to Don for insight on all markets, but particularly commodities. But this one is on the bonds, and as we know, the turn in the bond market is upon us. So I can't think of anyone better to look cross markets and assess what that means. So Don, thank you so much for joining me on the Salieri Report.
It's a pleasure, Catherine. So
negative interest rates. What in the world has happened?
Well, you know, I've been in this business since 1972, and I thought I'd seen everything. But the idea of negative interest rates and negative interest rates from Eurozone countries, some of whom are hovering on the edge of collapse, in the case of Spain, facing a secession of the only part of the country which has a positive cash flow. So you say, well, what has gone wrong? What has gone wrong here? What has gone right here? And I am of the view that Mario Draghi is a con man in the tradition of the Commedia dell'arte, and going back actually to the plays of Plautus, which those of you who have seen The Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, this is as fantastic as the opening song in that, where, of course, it's all about lies and deceits and deceptions and jokes. Because by definition, if you buy a bond with a negative yield on it, then what you're saying is you're trying to limit your losses. And to have banks buying these bonds is truly astounding. And the fact that we're north of $3 trillion in them does suggest that it's that moment when you say, yes, the 32-year-old bull market in bonds has reached its NASDAQ 5,000 range, which is, of course, where NASDAQ, before NASDAQ collapsed, as I commented in the text, I nearly lost my position as the global portfolio strategist for BMO Financial Group in 1999 by telling clients to get out of tech stocks. And NASDAQ's online stocks, they simply doubled in price in the next 9 months after I made the recommendation. I mean, I was awestruck, gobsmacked, and nearly smacked out the door. And then, of course, the eventual recognition crept in, and it blew in then, and people wondered how it had ever happened and that sane human beings had ever believed this stuff. But at least with those, even if they're trading at 150 times earnings, what you could say, if you compounded earnings for 150 years, you could break even. But if you have a negative interest rate bonds, no matter how long you compound it, you're losing money. So therefore,
unless, of course, you can sell, in theory, Don, couldn't you turn around and sell them to the ECB at a capital gain? If the ECB was buying above par, couldn't you anticipate a capital gain that would bring you even?
Well, this carries the greater fool theory to a new range. What it does, you're right that that's probably it. They're thinking there may be a squeeze because he's got to buy $1.5 trillion these bonds, and he's got to buy them relative to the GDPs of the countries so that they do know what's the supply. And the reason why German bonds in particular had done well was because no banks wanted to give up their German bonds when Draghi was bidding for them, because that's the highest quality bonds. But what this led to was 2 weeks ago, to a moment which also I will savor to my dying day. That was the week in which the yield on the German 10-year Bund multiplied by 18 times in one
week. What?
Yes. It went from 4 basis points to 72 basis points in one week. But if, see, again, if we had been having a phone call a year ago and I had said I had received a celestial vision that said there would be a week in the coming year where the yield on German 10-year bonds would multiply by 18 times, what you would, after the call was over, apologize to your listeners for having let this inflamed idiot get onto the call by mistake. But it happened. And so what it's fine for us to chortle about it, but we're talking about something here, which is, remember, the Eurozone economy is second only to the United States. And, well, it's just behind China. And but this, we're talking about a significant proportion of global GDP.
Right.
So the reason why I compare it to Plautus and Commedia dell'arte is that the traditions in all these comedies dating back to Plautus is of the bella figura, which is you put on a great smile and a great act and carry it off with panache, and nobody challenges you. You get away with it. And
right.
So that's the tradition. And by the way, the fellow who wrote Shakespeare's plays, we believe, Edward de Vere, did the grand tour, and he sat in on many of these, and that's where he got the character of Falstaff from, for his plays. So
right.
The thing about Falstaff, you remember, was he bragged all the time, but he somehow, when the battle was on, was nowhere to be seen. And but
right.
He proclaimed himself a military hero. Well, what Draghi is doing now is saying, I'm going to do this, and this is after the first time when he managed to knock gold down from $1,900 an ounce to $1,400 just by saying he was going to do whatever it took to save the euro. It was the single greatest success of a vainglorious boast for which there is an actual financial record. This time around, he had
right.
actually back his words by buying bonds. And that's how we got to negative yields. But with the
right, and he had to get the Germans to go along with letting him buy bonds,
well,
which is no easy
Germans,
feat.
Are also sort of impressed here because, you see, you get the governments in an area where they, whatever they might have been grumbling about because of their small-c conservatism, what he's doing, of course, is saving the taxpayers great amounts of money. It began when the governor of the Bank of Switzerland revalued the Swiss franc, and then he issued a 10-year negative yield bond. And the voters who had been shocked by what he was doing, by the sudden revaluation of the currency, suddenly discovered that if you went down through the debt then of Switzerland for years ahead, you had a negative yield, and therefore the more they borrowed, the less it cost. Now, when you can
right.
do that for your taxpayers, you're pretty good. Now,
right.
you know, I know it's not something that can be sustained, and for your client's concern, it is, we are being given a signal loud and clear that the 32-year bull market in bonds is over. And
right.
therefore, what that means is, you say then, well, okay, we know that it can't go on forever, but what happens next? Well, then you look at another statistic. The 70% of the marketable bonds in the world that are managed out there are managed by 20 companies. So we're coming into a bear market for bonds, and remember that unlike a bear market in stocks, where you can have a bear market in some kinds of stocks, but say gold stocks and maybe utility stocks might go up. When there's a bear market in bonds, they all go down because the only
thing right.
that they have to offer is a coupon.
Right.
So therefore, what we have is that we're going to have a bear market remember that we haven't had one for 32 years, but I came into this business in 1972, just after Nixon closed the gold window, and the biggest bear market in bonds of all time was about to happen. It only lasted for a few years. But from 1972 until late 1980, it was a horrendous one, taking treasury yields from 6% to 16%. So I'm not saying it's going to be that serious, but the amount of bonds that are outstanding now are a gigantic multiple of what there were back then. We used to think that Nixon was spent too much money, but that's just a good month for Obama. So it's going to be a really big story. And indeed, it may be the only really big story, because what it is that everything that's out there in this asset class is at risk. Now, the range of the risks varies. But if we're talking about, let's say if somebody says, well, the S&P's got to go down 15%, it's overvalued, fine. But that still may mean that the bond markets and some other parts of the stock markets, other parts of the world could go up. If we have a bear market in the Eurozone, which spreads to treasuries, then we'll have a global bear market in bonds. And then that's going to affect all sorts of decisions. It's going to affect government budgets. But what it's going to do is it's going to mean that for the elderly who have savings, and for pension funds, and for insurance companies, that the long, long years of hell of having to live with low, low interest rates while they have contracts out there. I mean, the typical U.S. state pension fund is discounting its liabilities in the range of 6 to 7 3/4, or in the case of Illinois, of course, which is dead last, which is where I live, 8 3/4. Well, how do you discount your liabilities at that? Well, of course, what they did in Illinois was bought all sorts of elaborate financial instruments peddled by out of the back door of somebody's van. And, of course, they blew money on that. And then, of course, they bought tech stocks. And just before, I mean, they've done everything to try to get around the fact that yields are so low. So what we have then is, I suggest that for most people, the bond market is something dull. If you look at the amount of coverage there is for it in the media, treasury yields were up, you know, 8 basis points today on a sell-off day. Well, that's not a big thing. But if you understand it in the sense that we're talking about amounts of money vastly bigger than the value of equities, and that they're going to, one way or another, move more or less like each other the same way. So it's more like a coming ice age than it is about a bad summer in Death Valley.
Right.
That's the thing. And because we don't have any precedent for this, remember, these yields, before we even went to negative yields, we had accomplished something that I didn't think I'd live to see, which was British gilts, who've been around since Adam Smith's time, reached their lowest yield in history. So, first of all, the only thing is nowhere to go but up. And then, for a while, we will have intervening rallies, and then it will start to sink in that they have to go up a lot before you actually can show some returns. For example, a 30-year Treasury zero has a face value of around 40, roughly. Okay, so to get a return on that, if you get up to a higher yield, what's going to have to happen is those bonds are going to have to go down to like 20, right, or 10. I mean, the mathematics are terrifying. Now, I'm not using all these superlatives to amuse. There literally is no precedent, none.
Right.
And therefore, what I find most alarming, and I'm glad we're having a chat, is that the way it's being discussed is as if whatever happens here, well, we've had sell-offs in the bond market before. Remember, not only is there nobody managing money today who was managing treasury bonds back in John Kennedy's regime, there's very few who are managing them during the bear market under Nixon. But when you find out that those yields pre-Napoleonic Wars were higher than this, then what you realize is that we do not have precedence. And if you go over to the textbooks, you will not find anything that will prepare you for what has to happen to go to normals, as we think of them, yields. So no wonder when they sit down at the Fed and talk about, well, you know, isn't it about time now that, you know, unemployment is virtually disappearing? Aren't we going to try to normalize things? Then somebody says, if it happens while I'm here, I'm going off the FOMC next year. I think I'd rather leave things in place because I know that every textbook that will be written for the next 200 years will describe who was on the Fed at that time.
Yeah, nobody wants to be Pontius Pilate.
Yes. So it is. You've been doing this for a long time, and this is probably the first call you've ever had where it said that the most scary thing out there, and yet the thing that provides the greatest opportunity, is the bond market, right?
Yes. I think the greatest opportunity is you're talking about tremendous dislocation in this huge pile of assets that's going to then send all the other markets in different directions. And I think you're going to get your opportunity in the equities, not in the bonds, because you're going to have such a liquidity issue. I don't see where the opportunity is in the bond market. To me, it's in what happens in equities.
Well, there's no question about it. In equities, one of the things that's going to happen is that virtue will finally be rewarded. In other words, the companies that didn't lever up their balance sheet in order to buy back stock and pay more dividends, those are the companies that people will be rushing to because they'll have pristine balance sheets. And those that did, you know, when IBM borrowed billions because they could borrow it at 1%, meanwhile, they were using it to buy back stock, and somebody said, well, why don't you try and grow your earnings instead? Or if not, make sure you keep your balance sheet strong because there might be a time that you'll need a strong balance sheet. What we know is that every bond that's going to be rolled over, and so many of them borrowed 1, 3, and 5 year area because it was so cheap, they're going to be rolling over that debt at higher rates. We don't know how much higher. What we do know is they're not going to be able to get the rates they got when they raised the money.
Right.
And therefore, long-term earnings forecasts.
I think there's a bigger problem than what rate they can roll it over in. Because if you now look at the construct of the market, Don, I think there are real issues of liquidity. In other words, it's not – let's say the corporation's willing to pay any rate possible. You know, is the money necessarily there, period, unless the central banks provide it? I mean, you're talking – you said there are 20 companies that now make a market for 70% of the market. What happens when every holder of a bond ETF or a bond mutual fund says, you know something, I want a shorter duration, so I'm just going to shift?
Mm-hmm.
There's no – who's going to make a market? Because you're talking about a market where there is no buyer.
That's right. Because the lovely thing about the bond market, the same reason that people think it's dull, is the absolutely open mathematics about what it is. And therefore, you know, if you think that yields are going to go up 200 basis points, You know how much money you'll lose on the your bond portfolio when you look at what its duration is, and you could, that's printed in your prospectus. You can calculate how much money you're going to lose. And they say, there's no way I can escape it. There's no way they can move from one set of bonds to another to do anything more than mitigate the disaster. They're all going to go down. And so it's a situation where there's nobody out there who's experienced anything like this. You can say, well, those who were in the Weimar Republic went through it because, of course, the value of the Deutschmark was subtracted by billions. But that was one small thing, and it was left over from the disaster of World War One. We're talking about the world now. And I am amazed at the insouciance of the financial pages about this, there's going to be a series of hiccups in the bond market. Both the Bank of England and the Bank for International Settlements have said there is going to be a big bond market crash. They talked about the two bond quick crashes that we had, flash crashes, last year. For the first time, they didn't start in the stock market, they started in the bond market. But they were still very small, they were bought up in a hurry and closed. The next one, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, this time water, the fire next time. They can't throw water on it now because everybody is in water, in effect, because the interest rates are so low. So the way in which you defended against crashes, which was by liquefying, that won't work. So the tools that the central bank has to anesthetize or indeed cure a sell-off won't work when it's the problem is the bond market. So it is quite a question where the people who win out of this the most will be those who've given up on everything else and been keeping money in their savings account and hoping for better days. They're going to have better days. And the only thing that they should be doing, of course, is getting still relatively short-term contracts, but they will be at higher yields. Because if we take bond yields back to where they were before the crash, we're going to have a sell-off of, gigantic amounts, 25, 30%, something like that overall in the bond market. And so there's nobody out there operating bond funds who's experienced anything like that except in the worst end of the junk bond market.
Well, you can see, I think, one of the great leading indicators of what the problem is has been Bill Gross's meltdown.
Yes.
I don't know if you've been watching it, but essentially what you've seen is someone who, looking ahead, does not want to be responsible for the world's largest bond market bond fund coming into this, and rather than just admit that and turn it over to someone else, instead has to make quite a drama of it. But what you're really seeing is his appreciation of what's ahead and trying to get out while the getting is good.
Well, it's, to use an analogy, it's almost like being somebody who's gotten rich from dealing with treatments for over a period of months for venereal disease, and then suddenly they discover penicillin and you haven't got a job anymore.
Right. Well, let's go back to the 20 companies that have 70%. You're running a mutual fund that is, let's say it's long treasuries. You're running a mutual fund that's long treasuries. Suddenly you get waves of redemptions, but there are no buyers for your underlying assets. What do you do?
Well, if you're running a treasury fund, yes, there will be buyers because I think the Fed can step in and help you there, and they undoubtedly will. But if you've got a diversified bond fund, which is most of them, because you've got all sorts of corporates, Wall Street can't help you much because under Dodd-Frank, they've got to constrict their exposure. And it used to be that we had the small banks around America who participated in trades, particularly of regional companies that they knew. And they gave support to the broad bond market. Well, as a result of Dodd-Frank, where all the banks in a spirit of equality, they're applying the rules of Dodd-Frank to the corner banks, with the result that there's been a total of 4 new banks incorporated since Dodd-Frank came out in 6 years. And of the 4, the one is my favorite, is the one of Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, operated by Amish. And its unique feature is that they have a window out at the front of the bank so you can come by with your horse and buggy to do your banking. So this is one of 4 banks. We used to incorporate several thousand banks a year. 4 banks in 6 years. So therefore, what we've taken away, Catherine, we've taken away the invisible support for the diversified bond market. We've done it by under with 10,000 pages of regulation.
Well, it's important to understand that all those financial institutions not only pulled their capital out, but they laid off, you know, they downsized and laid off their fixed income divisions. Mm-hmm. So the human capital, the intellectual capital that made those markets is gone, and it's not so quick to get it back.
Yeah, well, this is the delightful thing about this is that you can sort of think ahead to see why it is that a prediction, once you know that interest rates have nowhere to go but up, and that's why the 18-to-1 increase in German Bund yields in a week is a lovely statistic to think about.
Right.
Because you would say that is impossible. Right? If you were told second best quality investment bond in the world had the yield on its bond, and this is on a 10-year bond now, okay, that it increased by 1,800%, then you would say, well, the world is falling apart. It's like that line in Juno and the Peacock, the whole world's in a state of chassis.
Well, let me bring up something this is bad enough, but let me bring up something. I also remember, you know, the spike in yields and the incredible bear market. And so I remember 1980 when the prime just shot up anyway. But, you know, so I've lived through that. But no one's ever lived through a strong bear market in bonds with a huge load of interest rate swap derivatives on top of it. The majority of the derivatives book in the globe are interest rate swaps. And no one's ever managed a large book of interest rate swap derivatives with a big turn in the bond market. That is a wholly new experience. It's never been done.
And the beautiful thing is that those are big financial firms. And because of the perception that the risk factor in interest rate swaps is less than it is of actually holding the bonds because of the amount of capital is needed, then they've been allowed to stay in that business. I am one of those who felt that was the key to it was the derivatives that got us into the crash, financial crash, the lockdown. So I'm glad you're raising this because we got all sorts of bets being made out there, and everybody says it's all laid off in each direction. But there's nobody out there who's preparing for the kind of increases that can occur here. So we can hope that what happens is it's spread out over 5, 6, 7 years. But I don't believe that because there is nobody who's been managing a bond portfolio who's had to go through even 2.5 years of rising rates in
right.
the last 32 years. There's always been a rally. And they can't. The Fed can't rally because unless the Fed starts assigning negative interest rates. And if they do, you can bet that Janet Yellen will be hauled up before a congressional committee saying, what are you doing? And she says, well, if that's what the ECB is doing, and after all, Mario Draghi was educated at MIT just as Stanley Fisher. As a matter of fact, he was educated by Stanley Fisher, who happens to be the Fed vice chairman. So therefore, it's okay. I don't think that will satisfy the Republicans. So it's one of those things where you can come up with scenarios about it, and you all of them at this point are to some extent fanciful, but none of them can be disproved because we have no experience with this and with the sheer scale. Trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, euros, yuan, you name it. And they all, like the childhood song, a tissue, we all fall down.
Right. Now, there's another aspect to this. Now, we've talked about what happens in the bond market, but one of the things that's surprising to me as I look at the news, Don, I see hundreds of stories that are all about the turn in the bond market, except they look like very different things. So whether it's the credit issues in Greece or the credit issues in Chicago, they're all related to the cost of capital and the earnings. You know, part of the Chicago story is the pension fund not getting the earnings that it needs. So I see many different stories, and I think the big one is now we're talking about something as this turn happens, whether it happens nice or rough or fast or slow. You're talking about dramatic increases in the cost of capital to government vis-a-vis corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's going to have, you know, if you've lived with government spending more and more money and more and more money from 1980 forward, you've never been in an environment where government has had to spend less money, let alone pay back its debt. And so a turn in the bond market means literally a flip to almost an inverse fiscal environment, which is completely alien to most of the planet.
And, you know, I testified back in 1989 before the Senate Finance Committee, Subcommittee on Social Security. I was sent down by the Canada Pension Plan to have testify why it is the Canada Pension Plan was doing so much better on its income than Social Security was. And so I went through 3 years actuarial statements, and I was all set. And when they called me, I proceeded to point out that the Canada Pension Plan at that time, all the bonds it had were 20-year government bonds of the provinces, okay? And so we were in a bull market for bonds, which meant that they had locked in high yields. And then I pointed out that the big blunder that the Social Security Administration was taking was that they were buying their bonds not to change the overall duration of the national debt, because that would raise interest costs, and that would have to be paid for immediately by today's taxpayers. So anyway, I was explaining this, and all of a sudden, I saw somebody whispering in the senator's ear. This was Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and he said, I'm sorry, Mr. Cox, you have to step down. I've been advised that the testimony that you're giving is false. I said, Senator, I'll step down, but I've got the last three actuarial valuations here, and I've marked with spots the exact points from the actuary's report. And so, anyway, he says, well, just a minute. Why don't you stay there? We'll call another witness. And he waved to somebody on the other side who disappeared. He came back during the next witness's testimony. So Moynihan called me back, and he said, Mr. Cox, this committee gives you an apology. The testimony you gave was absolutely accurate. This committee has been misled by the Social Security Administration.
Unbelievable.
So he came down to me afterwards, and he said, I've looked up your background. And he said, you've been on the masthead of National Review for 20 years. And he said, you were sent to us by the Canada Pension Plan Board as being the leading expert on the plan, and that you were on the advisory committee that structured its investments. And said, why would a guy like that be involved with a socialist program? And I said, the socialist program label is not appropriate for a program which is overwhelmingly popular and which is a source of the income for retired Canadians. As a matter of fact, I believe that people in the financial community who have special knowledge should be prepared to donate their time, which is what I did, to help make that program run better. And I dug into why it was that they were buying so many low-yield bonds, and I found out there was a technicality that they were using as the basis, the yield on one $100 million 3% perpetual issue issued in the depths of the Depression. So we got it revalued to current rates, and we extended, and this was, of course, you know, with rates at now at 8%, so it's extended the life of the plan by 3.5 years. And he said, you did all that. And you're a follower of Bill Buckley. And they said, and he said, you did that for free. And I said, yes. And he said, I guess there's a difference between Americans and the Canadians. He says, we couldn't expect to have somebody do that in this country. He said, too bad. So he said, we're going to go back and we're going to file a report. But he said, Don, I can tell you there's no chance of changing the policy because the Congressional Budget Office will say, aha, that immediately increases the deficit and you're going to have to raise taxes to offset it. So the result is that we come into, we've gone through the long fall in interest rates, and Social Security was always investing at the front end of the curve, so they weren't investing. That's the big reason why Social Security is in the trouble it's in. If they had had one-year bonds, they would still be extremely well-funded. So we got a chance now that it's turning around. I say we collectively because I've been living in the States since 1992. And we got a chance by extending duration on the bonds as they're coming into this. They're going to increase their income, and that will put off the collapse of Social Security. So, but again, the reason I'm commenting on this is that it changes everything, and therefore what we've got to do is go back to the drawing board with all sorts of things. Corporations have to look at how their balance sheets work. Pensions funds change because we are changing the most fundamental of all things. Remember, Einstein said that the most powerful force in the universe is the law of compound interest.
Right.
And so what that ceases. As a matter of fact, when you have negative yields, that means the most powerful force in the universe is negative compound interest. So it's a black hole.
So what does this mean to equities? Let's talk about that.
Well, what it means right off the bat is that you're not going to have big corporations using up 100% of their cash flow to buy back stock and increase dividends. That game will be over, which is good because we've got a chance of growing the country now. The core of capitalism has, since Adam Smith's time, has been the reinvestment of profits by business managers in their businesses. We've taken that away for the last 6 years because we've been told by the activists and hedge funds, what you do is you give them stockholders money now and you borrow up and lever up at these absurdly low interest rates. To cover the fact that you aren't growing your earnings. So therefore, what we're going to have is a chance, maybe a last chance, for capitalism to prove that its principles work. So I'm pleased about that. They had to be knocked on the head by this to take it away. But so that's a good thing. The next thing, of course, that we see in this is that there will be massive refinancings of companies as they try to reduce the duration of their debt. And in a funny kind of way, what this will mean is that ordinarily you'd say, well, the junk bonds would all collapse. But what it'll mean is that if we, say, get oil prices back up to, say, $75 a barrel, that the most conspicuous borrowers, 62% of junk debt issued 2 years ago, was for frackers, that their bonds will start looking good relative to others because they're short duration bonds and they will be covered. So as the Bible says, they that are last shall be first. But again, there will be all these opportunities for people. And I'm still in the early phases, quite frankly, of thinking through this. It was a big thing for me to come out and write that piece and make a prediction saying it's the end of the bond bull market. And this is it, because the number of people who've made that forecast in the last 10 years, all of them lost their jobs.
Really?
Yes.
Well, recently, though, you've seen Jeff Gundlach and the guy at Fortress, and there's a lot more calls. And I think, to me, one of the most meaningful calls is simply Gross's meltdown.
Yeah, that's a big sign. But what they're saying, what they're talking about is what's going to have sort of happen in a couple of years. I'm saying it's over. That once this starts going, that the forces are going to be so strong. And so we're going to enter a longer-term bear market, which we have not seen. We have seen it we didn't see it in the last century even. So it is, what I'm also worried that we're going to see a crash where there's the Fed doesn't have the ability to do anything more than buy treasuries, and corporations will have to try to rush in to buy their own bonds. There will have to be all sorts of strategies put in place.
Why would they? Why would a corporation have to buy their? Why would a corporation have to buy their own bond?
Well, if what they,
I mean, it may be an opportunity for them.
Well, this
but
is the thing, but also that they, if they were planning to do some, they had some plans to be doing some refinancing, okay? And if they all of a sudden discovered there were no bids for their existing corporates, all their chances of doing any refinancing would be gone. So that would be a case where Treasurer would step in to maintain the liquidity of their bonds. If you have a $50 million bond issue outstanding now and you've got a deal because you're opening a pipeline and you need to raise $300 million, and you suddenly discover there's no bids for your bonds, and all of a sudden they're going from 8% for a presumed 12%, you can bet the treasurer of that company is going to step in and buy their own bonds.
Right. One of the things I've thought a lot about is, will the equity market, I mean, you could, the equity market, one of the unnerving things about watching this is the equity market could have some pretty, there are different scenarios with pretty dramatic shifts. You could see a real drop in the equity markets, but you could also see a crash up because the bond market is so much bigger than the equity markets. Where's that money going to go? It's got to go someplace.
Well, yeah, it can't all go into cash. It will create for companies that have not been borrowing to pay dividends and buy stock, it's going to create a once in corporate history lifetime opportunity to do deals. Because if you're the one with the cash and you've got somebody that's about to go bankrupt because they need to roll over their debt and they can't do it, you're in a position to buy assets really cheap.
Right. And I'm assuming the insurance companies have a way of coming out well on this, because they really, at this point, they need rising rates if they're going to meet their obligations. Isn't that the case?
Oh, absolutely. The I started off my career with Mutual Life of Canada, and I'm extremely familiar with how the actuarial process works on life insurance policies, that is, whole life policies. And there was no provision ever made in this for interest rates on long-term Canada bonds getting down to the level of 1.25%. If these are sustained for like another 5 years, then Canadian insurance companies would be struggling to survive at all. So, so for them, it's really important. It's because it's such a change. It's waking up in the morning and looking and saying, a little odd, I guess I didn't know where I was going to bed at night. The sun is rising in the west. How is that possible?
I was going to say the sky's green. Now, you think, Dunn, you, in your May journal, you talk about why you think this is going to be good for gold. So if you could just mention a little bit on that.
Well, first of all, gold is the only asset class that has existed forever and which has never paid a dividend or never paid any interest. And so, therefore, it's the one that has the most to lose from a period where interest rates were high or where there was lots of money flowing out from corporate dividend increases through refinancings. And
right.
So, therefore, then when we got to the stage of negative interest rates, what the Europeans had done was suddenly created a situation where gold had a higher yield than government bonds. Now, again, I never thought that would happen, but you're flexible when you see it, so you can say, all right, would you rather have a 10-year Italian bond paying 1.2% if they can do it, okay, or would you rather own, if you're going to be locked in, would you rather hold gold for the next 10 years? I think the answer to that is when the interest rate spread gets down to such absurdly low levels, you say, well, I'd rather have that. Besides, I got to pay tax on the income on my Italian bond interest. And Italy may not survive for the next 10 years because you've got the Lega Nord out there who wants to take away the top part of Italy, leaving it at Rome and Sicily. And that's not a viable entity. So you look at all those things. And it takes away the first argument that always everybody has used, and they've thrown it at you and me and at everybody who supports gold, saying it never pays any income. Why have it? It's just a pure speculation. I come back, well, at least it's a pure speculation. But then the next thing about gold in this is that it's because when you have financial chaos and the old ratios start to break down, then by definition, the kind of asset that's always been, for which there's always been a bid, will become valuable. Everything seems comfortable and there's not even any threat of governments seeming to go bankrupt because they don't have to pay much interest on their debt, then gold, you say, what are you afraid of? It's not going to protect you against Putin. It's not going to protect you against an Iranian nuclear bomb if you're thinking about the things you're afraid of. And it's right. Not even going to protect you for four more years of Obama, and he's not going to be around anyway. So it's my view is that it is an asset there that can be judged where the comparative assets are of the bond market where you can find it will be in chaos, and the gold market will never be in the kind of chaos that the bond market can be in. We know that.
Right.
Because
right.
The gold That's... market is a true world market.
Right.
So,
well, the bond market is a world market,
With the bond market, you've always got two plays in it. You've got the currency, and then you've got the interest rate, you've got the duration, you've got several factors. Gold is very simple. It's only one thing. And so I believe that it is good if you – everything that you and I have been agreeing on in this call is that the level of risk in the financial system is vastly greater than almost anybody wants to admit. Gold is the thing you buy when you think the whole financial system could be in trouble. Look what happened back in 2008.
Well, I think there's something else. You have 1.4 billion Chinese and 1.3 billion Indians who are absolutely committed to the notion that gold is money. Mm-hmm. And if you get a real, a sudden desire by large holders to sell massive amounts of gold inventory, you have buyers. In other words, mm-hmm. the market can adjust through price. What we're looking at in the long bond market is a market that may not be able to adjust through price.
Yeah, because it's because the gold market has always been there and the bond market quotes has always been there. But we're going to be seeing, because we have lots of these negative interest rate bonds out there, and then we've got vast amounts of debts that are denominated in a currency which didn't exist 30 years ago. Gold's been priced for 10,000 years. So we look at all of these things and you say, simplicity, a long track record, and quick portability. Those are things that aren't attractive if the stock market is going up and the bond market is going up and real estate prices are going up. But when real estate prices stop going up as soon as interest rates start climbing dramatically, so you look right through it and say, I was just thinking that the only thing holding the S&P back at all was its multiple. But, boy, if interest rates are going up, we know that hurts the stock market. So what we're going to have is when all the other assets become less attractive, Catherine, then gold becomes, by default, a more attractive asset. Because nothing...
Right. My only concern is the central bankers have enormous interest in some of those scenarios of keeping it down. So that's my only concern, because they know what you know.
they'll try that, but then if they suddenly resort to printing money like mad to save the system after having sworn off forever of doing it, they're going to be even bigger rush into gold.
One of the reasons I was so pleased with your report is if I've made a mistake as an investment advisor, it's holding too high balances of cash and short durations in bonds, because my concern was this was going to come sooner than I think it is now. But I noticed that in your allocations you recommended increasing cash and shortening durations. The reason I mention that is if you look at the primary reason why index funds do better than active managers, it's because the active managers have too much cash. So right now I would rather underperform than not have that cash.
Well,
so
I think,
was very pleased to see that.
It certainly makes sense, because remember, this particular kind of risk has never happened before.
Right.
Therefore, it's a very brave or audacious person who says, oh, we're going to be able to go through this okay. No, we don't know. And after all, the bond market, if it's so brand new, and that's why we entitled it Think Negative Thoughts. Because if you all of a sudden discover that there's two poles to the bond market, it's always been a unipolar market. It was just a question of how high it was in yield.
Right.
But if there's two poles to it, and if central banks can print money and drive yields into negative territory, so that the more you own of them, the poorer you are. You see, as soon as I mention that, think about it. That is a contradiction in terms. This is Alice in Wonderland. I mean, Lewis Carroll would love this. He would be able to make up great poems about showing Mad Hatter central banker who's, say, getting rich because he's bought a bond that's yielding 200 basis points negative, whereas the Dormouse is only getting 80 basis points negative.
I don't know if you saw the quote from the Danish central banker that said, don't challenge us on this because we can keep going negative as much and as long as we want. I put it up on the website. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't. But yes, they can.
I'll send it to you.
But it is a sign of a mania when the only reason for owning it is to get income. And what they're saying is, now you want to do it, and you're giving the government the right to voluntarily reach into your pocket and not do it through the tax system. That is a form of masochism previously unknown to mankind.
Right. I should point out that during the Great Depression, we saw treasuries go negative for short periods of time. And I remember I was during the 1991 meltdown in the housing market here. I was, I guess it was later in the 90s, I was on the board of Sallie Mae, and I remember Sallie Mae trading through treasuries for a short period of time and just a hint of negative. And obviously we've seen it in the last couple of years during the bailouts, but nothing, you know, as a matter of financial history, we've never seen institutionalized negative rates across the board. And certainly I don't remember, you know, when treasuries went through to the negative, it was not out to 9 years. So the Swiss selling at 10 years with negative interest rates, that's an absolute first.
Yeah, there hasn't been something as audacious as that since William Tell.
Well, Don, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I really appreciate your efforts on this
talking to you, and enjoy Australia, and you and your followers can look forward to a very interesting and different kind of financial market.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that was remarkable that has really struck me, I've been in Australia for about a week and a half now, and one of the reasons I wanted to come is I kept getting reports of clients who were in Asia and Europe coming back and saying, you know, everybody's happy here. Everybody's living their life. Everybody's, you know, because right now the United States is a terribly unhappy place is what I see and hear. And I'm struck.
Aussies are delightful people. And they are used to being laid back because of the extremes. Have you been into Alice Springs yet? Go into the Central Park, and then what you see is what they have to put up with from dry weather. And this is not Death Valley, of course, but what they have then is a lovely sense that life will come back. And they're fun people to be with, so you'll have a good
time. Right, they live with the wild swings of the commodities market. And I expected with commodity prices.
They enjoy the fact that they have animal life, which is unknown anywhere else in the world. And so you get to see these crazy animals that they have, these marsupials and so forth. And so in their own way, I guess you can call them, you can look at a kangaroo bounding and say, gee, that for somebody who's never seen it before, they'd say, gee, that reminds me of a negative interest rate bond.
Well, I did. I just saw my first kangaroo last week. So, but I expected with commodities down that the economy would be slower here, and yet it's going gangbuster despite that. So, and it's a pretty happy environment. But then they have this almost the same land mass as the United States and only 25 million people, so plenty of room. Well, anyway, Don, thank you so much joining us on the Solari Report. You have a wonderful day, and we look forward to your next thoughts on what's around the corner.
Pleasure.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.